The third myth is, I'll make it up to you.
The response to that is, you can't. You can't make it up.
Why? Because you can't. Today is today, and today will only be today. And you can only do today's living today. Tomorrow, you can't make up for today, because tomorrow will take care of itself. Tomorrow, you have to do tomorrow's living. This is the businessman's myth. I'm busy right now, but I'll make it up to you. No, you can spend more time. Listen, you can spend more time tomorrow than you did today, but you can't make up for today. You got to be where the being is. Now, let me say a word about this, four more things about time. Some children, if you're going to raise, and this gets over into child raising, some children take more time to raise than others do. Some relationships require more time. That's why, Lori, I didn't want to draw, harder, set an agenda or schedule. This overlaps with our child raising, but do you realize that a lot of parents don't know their own kids? By the time they get to be teenagers, a lot of teenagers are actually strangers to their own parents, and they know it. Any youth minister will tell you this. And why? Well, one of the reasons often is time, because it takes time. Now, I can testify, Linda and I can testify, that some children take more time than others. I know when Leandra was a teenager, she come in. Of course, now, we have a rule at our house that you have a right to privacy. You can go in and close your room and close your door. But you don't have an absolute right to privacy. And the rule is, while you're living under our roof, if you're thinking it, it's our business. How can we raise our children? How can we be parents to them if we don't know what they're thinking? Understand? You do not have a right. In other words, one of the things you cannot tell us is, it's none of your business. You ever tell your parents that?
Just once,
yeah. It's none of your business. Well, kids think that. It's part of growing up, especially when you get to be teenagers. Sort of in the genes. When the hormones flow, that's one of the things that they pick up. It's none of your business. And if you want to see one mad father, you just let a kid tell me it's none of your business. Look, as long as you're my kid, it's whatever. Everything about you is my business. You go out and you're on your own, and you become your own independent person, then you can say that. But now, it's my business. A lot of kids don't get the kind of leadership they need from their parents simply because the parents don't take the time. Now, Leandra, I can give a family example. This will make Leslie mad. Leandra was the kind, which is our oldest daughter, that she didn't take much time at all. If she went on a date, or whatever she was thinking, she'd tell you much more than you wanted to know. One of my favorite memories is like being sound asleep and all of a sudden wake up and here's Leandra sitting on the side of the bed telling her mother, blow by blow, I mean minute by minute. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, enough's enough, be quiet. And I finally, sometimes I'd run them out. They'd go to her room so I'd get some sleep. Just tell everything, just immediately, what's on her mind just comes out her mouth. Some kids are like that. You know, if it's on their mind, it comes out their mouth. And they just know, what they're thinking. Aaron's a lot like that. Leslie, our second daughter, the Sphinx. No, she was the son. She'd say, I can remember coming in from a date, whereas Leandra would just blah, 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 blah. Leslie would, Linda would say, well, how did everything go? Okay. Did you have a good time?
Yeah.
Well, what happened? I don't want to talk about it. Anything wrong? No, it was okay. Just leave me alone. I'm okay. No, and I've heard Linda say this. Well, you might as well tell me now because you're going to tell me later. I'm not going to give up on you. I'm not, And then she'll start pumping, asking questions. Well, did this happen? Did he say this? And gradually it comes out. I can remember one session. I'm glad Leslie's here. She needs to hear this. I remember one session, I was sitting back listening. It was hilarious. It started out as an argument. It started out with, leave me alone, you do this every time. You know, why do you push me like this? I want, you know, I don't want to talk, blah, blah. And Linda's, you know, my wife's very stubborn. You met her the other day. She doesn't scare easily. And she said, well, you're going to tell me, you know. And 45 minutes later, Leslie says, and I quote, "Mom, I'm glad you don't give up on me." So our children want to communicate. But you understand? What took 3 minutes with the angel took 45 minutes with Leslie. And she's still that way. And she knows she's that way. And my youngest son is that way. I'm telling you, you can come in from school. If Aaron comes in from school, he just, and something's bugged him, he tells you whether you want to know or not. Like Lanza. Adam comes home, he gets this grim look on his face. He goes to his room, and you got to go get to work. And it's just like, you know, sometimes we work in relays until we find out what's going on. But you see, if you're going to have kids, you got to know what they're thinking. And it takes time with some kids. Understand? You're not going to do that in 2 or 3 minutes. And so with little, I talk about teenagers, with little children. You want to know, a lot of parents have beginner age children, 4-year-old, 5-year-old, and they do not know their own 4- and 5-year-olds. Why? It takes hours to sit and listen to a child. And they'll talk and talk and talk, and you get to know them. And often the one who has to spend the more time is to be realistic, is the woman. The mother has to be the one, usually, to do this, to spend the time. Tanya, did you hand up?
I was just going to see if there was a difference between how you interact with your daughters as much as you interact with your sons. And did y'all ask about your son's time just as much as you did?
Exactly the same.
And it just depends on their personality.
It's not a male-female thing so much as it is they're just different personalities. So if you were like that, you know, aren't you? If I asked you, could you not tell me whether you were the kind that would just want to tell everything, or you were the kind that wanted to go off for yourself and keep it to yourself? You see, Linda and I teach that the children do not have that right. While you're sitting, you're in my house under my roof, eating at my table, and I'm paying your dental bills, and I'm responsible to God for raising you. You tell me. I got to know. So just like it takes time to develop a husband-wife relationship, it takes time to raise kids. Time.
They still need to have their own little secrets, though, too, don't
they? Yes, we don't. You know, all I'm saying is, what I said was, I'm glad you brought that up. Do children have a right to privacy? The answer is a limited right, not an absolute right. It's one thing for a child to be able to go in their room. I know children, parents who will not even let their kids close their door. I'm not making that up. You know, they get no privacy. You know, kids got a right to, you know, to go in their room, close their door, listen to their music, be alone, have privacy, have private conversation on the telephone. They got this right. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is what's going on in your heart. If something, you understand? If something's bothering a child, it is the parent's responsibility to know. And some kids you're not going to know in 5 minutes. That's what I'm saying. It's interesting. There have been kids, and Leslie could verify this, friends, boyfriends and girlfriends, boyfriends are just friends of my daughters. They were teenagers growing up, and now we have friends of my sons who my wife knows them better than their own parents. Because she's a listener, she'll sit down and listen. She'll take time. She spent 2 or 3 hours Saturday listening. We got sort of an adopted, you know, Tom, our Navy son. We got a young man. By the way, we got a young man named Tom, new Christian, at our church in Winter Park. He's from Oregon, and he's in the Navy. The Navy base is up the street from our house. And he's one of many. We go from one to the other because they come and go, you know. And on Saturday, he comes down to the house. You know, they get sick of living on the base. And he comes down, he's chilly with us. We always make chili on Saturday. And just whatever we're doing just shows up. We're glad somebody sits by himself and watches television. But Saturday, he spent 2 or 3 hours talking to my wife, but she sat down and listened to him because he had some things he needed to talk about. But it takes time. One of my favorite memories is the time I came home from work and there were two teenage boys sitting in my living room. Neither one of them came to see my daughters. They were former boyfriends who came to see my wife. They had something on their mind. And their own parents, who were professionals with a lot of money, Winter Park professionals, but their parents weren't there to listen. You see, because they didn't have time. And it started too late. Is this making sense to you? So it takes time. Now, the three myths, the end of the tunnel myth, the end of the tunnel myth, the quantity quality myth, and I'll make it up to you. Forget that. There's just enough truth in them to make them dangerous. Now, what are the results of overcommitment? Time, pressure, and fatigue. That is, if there's any such thing as quality time, it would figure in here, and that is, sometimes we must not give our families the ragged ends of our time. Because if you're too tired, if you've used up yourself or everybody else, and finally you work around to get some time to your family, and you're so tired you don't know what you're doing, then you need to change your plan. Now, this came home to me for a year. We always had a family time, family night when the kids were growing up. And remember this lesson? Friday night was family night. Pick them up from school, boy, they look forward all week. We'd go out. That was our family, that was our family time. Go to picnics, go out to eat, big time. That wasn't the only time we spent, but that Friday night was family night. And we used to have some real time. The kids would, but my family night, when I first started, when I got into local ministry, got out of school, settled down, I started making it Monday. I tried to make Monday night family night. Because Monday was a bad day anyway. I don't know how much, a lot of preachers, I was a preacher that, it took me till 11 o'clock on Monday morning to start believing in God again. After Sunday, I just washed out after Sunday. Monday's the worst day. If the Lord comes back on Monday, half the preachers in town go to hell, I promise you. After Monday, you just, your weekend is too much with you. And I couldn't do much effective work Monday anyway. In fact, if I tried to do work Monday, I'd have to spend all day Tuesday undoing what I did on Monday. I spent part of the time staring at the wall. And I thought, well, since it's such a bad, I give that to my family. Well, I didn't do that very long because I wasn't fit to be with. I was too tired and distracted. By Friday, I was feeling great. So I decided to give Friday to my family. It was a day away from Sunday. I could spend Saturday doing part of anyway, getting ready. And so Friday night was one of our best times. Well, that became Friday. You see what I'm saying? You can't give them the ragged. I learned that the hard way. You need to give them, cut off some of the good parts of the week for your family. Now, so time, pressure, and fatigue are the results of overcommitment. That is, if you run yourself into the ground, then you're short tempered with your kids. You don't have time. You don't feel like playing with them. That's bad. What are the solutions to the time problem? Number one, set priorities. We must be where the being is. I put this in the syllabus. Set priorities. Now, listen to me. You can't always keep your priorities. Did we always have family night? No. We almost always did, but that's better than not having it at all. Often people make the mistake, they think, because if I set a plan, since I can't keep to it perfectly, then I'll just forget the plan. No, a plan that you keep to 75% of the time is still better than no plan at all. And life does not permit you the kind of perfection and continuity that you can always keep it. But you set priorities.
Who was allowed, I say allowed, who made the decision on this, on these family nights? As the kids got older, did they start dating? Was Friday still family time, family night? Did you all try to keep that for a while, and there's sometimes...
Well, that works from the kids a little. When they get older, that structure breaks down. But it breaks down naturally. It's a good question. See what he's asking?
It's something you'd allow to break down, just let it...
You let it die a natural death. Then we still have family times. But the regular family night, then when the kids get old enough to be teenagers and they're dating and they get ball game, then it gradually disintegrates. But it doesn't hurt, you know.
I know, like the Mormon Church and some other people, they promote, like, you know, say Thursday night, whatever, it's held rigidly.
Yeah. That's a lot of mythology, like, you know.
Well, they teach that.
Yeah. But no, it's sort of, then it becomes less formal, less. But you see, it doesn't hurt anything.
But you still have it.
Hmm?
You still have it, even though one.
Well, not regularly. When the kids get to be teenagers, it gradually breaks down because they got their things to do. So you work in your family time in different ways, as opposed to having a definite family. But when little, we could have a definite family night.
But at one point, I say you got to the point where me and Angela had a date. Would the rest of the family still get together?
There was a point of tension in there. We had to, and sometimes we would have to say to her, look, it's time for you to work. This is the family time. You change your other plans. When you still got little ones at home, when you all get to be teenagers, then.
Did you find that they did that themselves mostly, or did you have to step in and say, would you change your plans?
We usually had to step in. Oh, we had to adjust it. You begin to adjust it more. Now, a lot of our family times, since I travel so much, if I'm home on Sunday, usually I take the family out to eat. If they're in, after all, that's a good family time. And often you mix family, as they get older, you mix family time in with kids. Like, for instance, if one of your kids is playing ball, you take the older kids, you all go watch them play. So you work, you don't always have to choose between the two. Not either or. You see what I'm saying? If you start out with the principal, then it works out less formally. But when they're little, that's a lot of years. Leslie can, don't you remember Leslie? For a lot of years, we had Friday night was family night. I mean, just for a lot of years. And you lay the foundation of it. And boy, the kids, they look forward to that. We used to really have some good times. Develop some traditions. We pick up the kids from school during the winter time. And we'd do all kinds of things. They hold you to it. Boy, you know, family night, Dad. You know, and you really got a good reason for breaking it, which we seldom did. Set of priorities. And the local, let me say to those who are going to be ministers, the church needs to know that you can go too far with this, but the church needs to know that your family comes first. If you want to lose your ministry, you lose your family, and you've lost your ministry. If your family doesn't work, you're going to have a very thin ministry. I mean that. And a lot of preachers, a lot of our big name preachers, have sacrificed their families to the church. There was a speaker, one of our largest churches, one of our best known preachers in the brotherhood, one time got up at the North American, and said, told how his oldest son swore and told him how he hated the church because the church took his dad away from him. Well, that was daddy's error. The church didn't do that. Daddy did that. You understand? And if your family doesn't, you understand, you can be the best pulpit man in the world. You can be the best programmer, the best administrator, but if your family doesn't work, you have very little ministry. Because people do not respect a minister who cannot control his own, cannot run his own home. And I promise you that's true. Well, so set priorities. Make family time plans as specific and binding as other important items on the agenda. You get this, preacher, we got to have this meeting Friday night. I'm not making this up, this happened. I can't be there. Why not? Well, I've got an appointment. And then sometimes that should be enough. You get some guy who's kind of a bore and say, well, what kind of appointment you got, you know, is it more important than this building committee meeting? And I said, yeah, I promised my kids we're going out to eat Friday night. It's our family night. That's my appointment. And it's interesting. They look at you like you're kind of funny. But by and by, after a while, they just accept it. They said, well, if we're going to meet that night, we'll meet without Chambers. Why? Because he's going to be there. Just as binding as any other thing. Now, it's interesting. Some of the young men who thought that was kind of odd, not very spiritual, would come around in later years for counseling, some advice on how to take care of their kids. Usually it's too late. Set priorities. And then the third, now this is more important, this is very important, especially to you young men who have young families at this point in your life. Be creative within the context of a crowded schedule. But I'm saying often family time can be combined with other things. It's a mistake to think you have to, whether we're talking about the husband-wife or parent-child relationship, it's a mistake to think you always have to choose between your responsibility, what you've got to do, and family time. You can make, now there must be just family time. And I recommend young couples, before they have children, to start family time before the kids come along. I recommend that. Time for each other. You understand? You schedule it. You schedule everything else. It's time together. But so besides the set family times, you can work all kinds of family time in with a busy schedule if you're creative. For instance, often wives go with their husbands on business trips. You're going to go somewhere to preach. The wife goes along. It's good family time. It's a good time together. You can talk. You can stop and get a meal out. You understand? So you're busy, but you're also together. This is especially true with children, especially true with fathers. One of the most valuable things a father can do is learn the art of taking a kid along. And I see fathers doing this. I think fathers do a good job of this. It's Saturday, you got a lot to do. But you haven't had much time with your kid. You got to go by the hardware store, you got to fix two or three things in the house. You know, take them along. And you can work family time in. Kids love to go along. And you stop because they know that you're going to stop and buy them a Coke, or you know, like you can buy McDonald's, you can stop and get a milkshake. They can con you. you know you're being conned, and you love it. And so you got your job, and get them to help you. And if you want, I'll give you an example. You want to turn a 6-year-old kid on, you let him help you do something. And ask him what he thinks. Ask his advice. Now, his advice probably won't be worth anything. But that's not the point. And we developed this. I'm just sharing these personal examples because I don't know how else to talk and teach the principle. There's a rule that Linda and I believe in, that every child needs to be an only child, especially if they aren't. Every child needs to be an only child sometime. Now, I think we're going to talk about this later, but that is, often if you got more than one child, especially if you got three or more, we had four, as you know. Kids sort of, they're sort of a part of a group, a gang. Come on, troops, you know. And sometimes you don't even get their name right. You know, every parent's done this. Come on, Joe, Charlie, you know, you go through the whole list. Sometimes I name all four kids and the dog before I get to the right kid. And sometimes what happens in a large family, that the youngest often gets lost in the shuffle. And so every child needs to be an only child. And this works when they're little. When they get to be 12 or 13, it doesn't work anymore. They develop their own interests. But I followed the policy for years and years that when I went on a trip, whether it was a long trip or a short trip, if I could, I took a child along. And Leslie and I have had a lot of hours together when I was very busy. Remember that time Leslie went to a mother-daughter banquet? Way up Northern Ohio, and it was her turn to go. Huh? Yeah, it was you. You don't remember. She was real small. I mean, real small. For a year, we used to teach at Cincinnati. It's about a 35-mile drive down. I taught at night, sometimes in the night class. And the girls took turns. They were preschool age. They took turns going. The rule was they'd go along and ride down with me, and they had their cousins there were students, they'd stay in the girls' dorm while I was taught, and I'd pick them up. And the rule was that we'd stop at Friendly's Ice Cream on the way back. You'd get almost anything you wanted. Or we'd stop at the donut shop. One child, one-on-one. And you understand, so you'd have to choose between. And when we moved to Florida, of course, our boys came along second. But the early years when I was here in Florida, I had one or two boys with me on lots of trips, stayed in lots of homes. Go to a week of church camp, take a kid along. Understand? What I'm saying is some of the best times I've had with my kids have been the times when I was the busiest. And it gives the mother a break. And pack the kid a bag and take him along. Whether it's down the hardware store or to a speaking date or whatever it is. See what I'm saying? And parents do this a lot. And you can be creative. Mix the two. Little kids love to go along with their daddies. It's a little more trouble. But they love it. And you can really have some good talks, have some good times. Any of your parents ever do that? Do you remember that with your parents, taking you along? And, you know, actually, it wasn't even pressure on you. They weren't trying to entertain you. They were just tagging along. And you remember riding in a cart at Kmart, you know, riding a little cart? Yes. That's true. It's a very practical thing to do, especially when you're busy. A lot of you do this, I know. I see you guys running around with a kid tag along behind. You know. Okay, be creative within the context of a crowded schedule. Any other questions or comments? Here are the final reminders on this study. Today is the only real time that exists. Tomorrow's gone. I'm sorry, yesterday's gone. Tomorrow is a myth. Tomorrow isn't real. It's an idea. Today's the only real time that exists. A day is longer for a child than it is for an adult. You know that? You see, this is true. Do you ever notice that the older you get, the more... You all haven't lived long enough to know this. That the older you get, the faster time flies. I remember I spent probably 4.5 years in the third grade with Mrs. Neumeister. Worst teacher. Oh, I hated Mrs. Neumeister. She didn't like me either. She didn't like anybody. I don't think she liked Mr. Neumeister. Everybody dreaded Mrs. Neumeister. But I thought I was going to live in... My idea of eternity was the third grade under Mrs. Neumeister. I thought I was going to just die in that. And remember how long it used to take between Thanksgiving and Christmas? I mean, years would pass, you know, before Santa Claus came. Now, it seems like you just get the Christmas, well, it seems to me, you know, you just get the Christmas lights put away and it's time to get them out again. Time does pass. But you see, time is what you conceive it to be. And the reason is time longer for a child. It is. You see, for a 5-year-old child, a year is only 1/5 of all the time they've ever known. 1/5 of their whole life. And 1/5 is a pretty good sized chunk. And that's how they think. Understand? You can only relate it to their total experience. For a 50-year-old, a year is only 1/50th of all the time they've ever known. And 1/50th is a much smaller fraction than 1/5. And that's how we conceive of it. So that when a 30-year-old spends an hour with a 3-year-old, it is longer for the 3-year-old than it is for the 30-year-old. Which is encouraging because time spent with a child is a good investment. Understand? He's getting more than you're giving. And people remember it that way. Kids will often say, adults will often say this, well, I remember when I was a kid, my dad used to always, and then, you know, well, always used to do. You go back and check, he didn't always do it at all. He probably didn't do it very often. But it seemed like always to the kid. He got the benefit of it. My dad used to spend hours with me. But you can ask the father, he said, no, I didn't spend hours. But the kid remembers it that way. That's a good investment, isn't it? You remember, the early years seem long, and the adult years fly. So, a day is longer for a child than it is for an adult. Good investment. So what I'm saying to you is this. What parents often say, especially dads, they'll say, well, I've only got 10 or 12 minutes. It's not worth it. They will not invest it. But you see, if you do invest it, the child will remember it. It will be for the child much longer. Little bits of time. But adults, especially adult men, tend to think in terms of large chunks of time. If I don't have 20 or 30 minutes, it's not worth the effort. Which is a fundamental mistake. And you've got to do it at the time. Many important things must be done today. If you've been thinking about having that conversation, do it today. If you think about saying it, say it today. Do it today. Today cannot be lived tomorrow. We cannot get ourselves off the hook with the promise that we'll do it. We'll do that someday soon. You have to say that sometime. You cannot always do it today. I realize that, but we must also realize that we cannot. That a promise to do it does not get us off the hook. Okay, any questions on time? Any of you have any favorite memories of family times that you could add to give ideas to other students? Did your family, any of you have good suggestions what your family did? Yes?
My dad used to be on a bowling league, and he would go every Tuesday night, and we would go about an hour earlier before he had to bowl in the league, and we'd just do a family bowling time before he had to bowl, and we'd sit and watch him.
That's interesting. That's good. Yeah, it's good.
And I guess as parents, I guess as kids grew up and you had that family time for parents to want to go.
I'm sorry.
For parents to be able to let go.
Yes.
Because I know
very hard.
Parents, they couldn't, and it hurt them. Why can't we get together anymore on Saturdays? I just didn't understand why their children were left home and didn't have time anymore.
That's an excellent point. I know when LeAngelo and Leslie got to be teenagers, and the structured family time began to disintegrate, died its natural death. It was harder on the kids. Didn't notice. It's hard on us, because what happens is you go for years and years, and you're all family time means everybody's there. And with the oldest child, my wife and I genuinely suffered to have a family night with only 3 kids. I can remember the first night at when LeAngelo was married and gone, when I would, of course, well, no, really the first night, when she went away to school, really. She went away to school, and I locked up the house that night with one kid missing, you know, who was sleeping, you know, who was at school, living somewhere else. That really hurt. And now, after a while, I get used to it. You know, now we're used to having, we just go whoever's there. But that first one, when you know, it's family night, but one of the kids is probably another family now. Sometimes you do resist it, but you have to realize it's natural. It's like taking the kids with me. The boys, when they were little, and the girls, you're just predictable. They love to go. It's crazy about going with dad until they get to be about 12. And then they start developing their own interests, their own friends, their own plans. And they get tired of it, and they don't want to go anymore. It hurt my feelings. With every kid, I knew it was coming. When Adam balked, you know, Adam was with me. No, I'm telling you, I really took it personally. I was deeply insulted. I had experienced three times before. But I had to remind myself, and you know, it wasn't anything personal. It's just that phase of life had been, you'd gone through that phase. And it's healthy, you see. We want our kids to develop their own personalities and their own lives. You can't keep them small. But it's very hard, like you're saying, your point's well taken, Scott. It's hard on the parents. The kids don't notice it. It's hard on the parents. The kids know it's natural.
You know, one of my favorite times is Mark and I will be driving home from somewhere, and we'll be pulling in, and they'll say, Daddy, so we got to go check the building. Yeah. That'll always be a fun memory for me, just to be happy.
Yeah. It's the things you do on the way. Some of those conversations you have, and some of the funny things that have funny memories. were my favorite memories. We had this main street of Hamilton that had two houses on it, and they were painted really odd colors, off yellowish colors. One was kind of a greenish, but they clashed terribly. They were both painted unusual color, and they clashed. It really eyesore. And every time we'd go by, my wife would say, "Those people must be at war with each other." Said that several times. And one time, I was taking Angela. She was with me. I was going to have her with me, and we were going down the street. She was about five, you know. And we were, and I wasn't even thinking about driving down the street. And she said, "Dad, there's those war houses." You're just for a kid, this 5-year-old kid, and I said, "What?" You know, and she, "Yeah, those people, those war houses, those people who are war." What she meant was the people who were at war with each other, because they painted their houses that clashed. It scared the liver out of me. I thought we're off the road, you know. But you do. Can the kids remember that? You build those. That's when you bond. I remember when I took Leandra to see Jungle Book, and she threw up right in the movie. And the whole theater hated us. I'm sure. Oh, it's terrible. So some of the memories are not so good. And what you must do. Now, this is very important, dads. When you take the kids along, you must make very sure that you don't convey the impression that you're doing them a great favor by taking them, that you're just putting up with them, patronizing them. That'll kill it. But nobody likes to be patronized. What you do, here's the words you use, I promise, what you do is you say to the kid, "Boy, I sure do appreciate you coming along with me. I know you're busy." This is a 7-year-old kid. "I know you're busy. And I got a lot of things to do. I really appreciate you coming along with me." Make him know that you're honored to have him with you. That you're not just putting up with him. You say that to a kid. And it's amazing the effect it has on them. You understand? You make him know that that he's doing you a favor in a way. What it does, it gives them a sense of their own self-worth. I'm not just some baggage. I'm not a problem that he's trying to solve. I'm not just something he has to tolerate. Adults don't like to be tolerated, and kids don't like to be tolerated. And you can convey that very easily. Just tell them. When you're out with them, be proud of them. I'm going to give you an example. You take along a 4 or 5-year-old kid, and you go into something, we used to do this on speaking dates, and you go into people's home, introduce your children as if they were an adult. "I'd like you to meet my son Aaron." Here's this little 7 or 8-year-old kid. And you shake hands, you've taught him how to shake hands. And you introduce him, I'd like you to meet my son Aaron. You know, that's my son Adam. And you shake hands. I tell you, it does something for a kid. Not just, you know, along as a person, not just a tag along. Some of the others got, these are good comments or questions. Anybody else? Leslie, you got anything to say about this? I don't want to put you on the spot. Yes, I do. you remember this? at these times? You remember Friendly's ice cream?
Yeah.
Always had chocolate on most of
it. It's important to, to have your kids be around adults and learn how to act around adults and treat them, like they're, because I know a lot of kids just don't have any respect for anyone. And it's important to have them be around, put them in situations where they need to act properly.
Yeah, the one someone stands on the ice, don't write a thank you note when they get home. These common courtesies.
I remember a time, you talk about treating a child like an adult. I remember my sister and I, she's 2 years younger, so she might have been 8 or 6 or something. My mom's best friend was Mrs. Emma, Lucy Emma, and she had said, one day she had said, no, don't call me Mrs. Emma, call me Lucy. Because that's just what she wanted. But I can remember my mom letting my sister and I, sitting down with my sister and I, letting us decide what we thought we should call. We opted for Mrs. Zimmer. I can remember thinking that was one of the, Mom really listens to what we have to say, at 8 and 6 or something. It's really.
And you develop memories. I know my son Aaron, I honestly think it's spooky, could see a McDonald's through a mountain. I mean, he'd see him, we'd be riding along, and he'd develop this travel with me. He loved eating McDonald's. He was little. The rule was, if you're traveling with Daddy, we eat where you want to eat, within reason. And I used to eat ice. I've eaten so many McDonald's. But he would see me. He said, "There's McDonald's, Daddy." And I'd squint, And I 4 miles later, I'd see the arches, I swear he could see through a mountain. It's spooky. I'm serious. With a good set of binoculars, I couldn't see that place. Boy, he could smell them, I think. He knew where they were. Okay, anybody else? Look, you sound like you're going to say something. You look like you're going to say
something. No, I'm just thinking about sometimes. I don't know if anyone's ever played Monopoly every once in a while. I couldn't tell you. That was a night. I'm feeling
bad. His dad would close down those cheap. That's what was going on in those hotels. We closed the hotels down. We're going to sign
them. We didn't have a problem. And we just had great things. I heard we played whenever we played Monopoly. Man, it turned out to be something. Big family argument.
Yeah. The happy wars.
We'd be up Saturday morning still arguing.
I want you to own him for staying on the boardwalk. And,
that's right.
You
know. Friday nights were always something to look forward to. It was a little different for us because we went to school with our parents, there's a piece on every day. But it was just something about Friday nights, It was just like get away from them and everything. So I can relate to that. It was a great night.
I have a hard time relating to kids who don't have parents didn't spend a lot of time with them. Understanding, just trying to think of what it would be like not to have, those times together, because my family always had them. I just can't imagine it. We always went on vacations together. We always played together. We always played games together. We watched TV together. When we watched TV, we all had a vote. Even my brother and I, we had a vote. And that made us feel important because what we wanted counted too. But I can't imagine it any other way.
What it does, it builds up a sense, and we're going to come to this later, we're talking about these principles, but it builds up a sense of family, a concept of family. We're a part of a family, which is security to a child. I'm secure, I belong, I've got an identity, security and identity. We're a part of this family. One of the things remember I said the youngest child tends to get lost in the shuffle? At our meals tended to be somewhere between a barn dance and a riot sometimes. And I'll tell you this story, then we'll close for the day. Adam was the last of the Mohicans. And he tended to develop a loud voice because he had to be heard. And everybody's talking at the same time. And so Adam, he couldn't get a word in edgewise because everybody's a talker in our family. And little Adam sitting there trying to get a word in edgewise. And as they develop their sense of humor, they want to tell these dumb jokes they think are funny, and you got to sit there and listen to these. The older kids groan. Then we say, yeah, but that's just exactly. They forget that they it was just the same way,
same jokes
that they weren't funny. But Adam, we developed this little plan. I think I got it from Johnny Carson's show. We had the rule that when especially the young ones wanted to speak, and I'd see a child trying to get a word in edgewise, I'd go da 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 da, and everybody had to join me. We go da 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 da, and now here's Adam. We'd all point, you know, there he is sitting right there. And everybody, and once you did that, you had to be quiet till he finished. Remember that? We go da da da. And well, here's the whole family with their, you know, with their hands. Here's Adam. There he is, a spotlight. He's on stage, Mr. Adam. You know, or here's Aaron, and he was growing up. And it gave them a chance to, you know, to tell their stupid joke or whatever. tell what happened to them in school today. You know, they get a, but you can, they can get easily get lost in the shuffle. Okay.
Any unusual experiences with your baby Ann that you want to share with us, other than the one who? Jim, look, I'm going to put your.
No, Jim.
Thank you. I want to look the murderer right in the eye.
Now, I've had enough. This will come off.
Oh!
I did do it on purpose.
Boy, she's getting hard boiled, isn't she?
I did do it on purpose.
We know. How many think she did it on purpose?
Well, really, and her egg was too young to die.
If she meant somebody would water, if she meant to kill that egg, somebody definitely would water. You know, water.
In English.
We're going. I'll tell her. Since these accidents happen, it'll. I told her if anybody else has the same accident she did early on in the game, I told her to get another one. I'll have to dock her grade a little bit for carelessness. Not much. It's early in the game, so she's gonna get another one. If it happens to anybody else, you know, these early first part of the week, why you have the same privilege. I realize an egg is not exactly like a baby. The problem with keeping an egg from breaking is so small. It's hard to, it gets banged around, you know.
That's right, so it won't fall out.
The meeting, I think it's a good idea to have a meeting of Egg Beaters Anonymous, because by about Tuesday you're going to really be ready to fling the thing. Yeah, you ready today? Keep in mind, you're changing it regularly and washing it. And you gotta do it all.
Well, Doc, my client's dressed down there, and he's not even white. You told me to get clothes on and stuff.
Yeah, it was a little, a nude egg, really. Okay. Let's get to our syllabus. I hope you all have a good time, a good weekend with your egg. Your baby. There's a lot of explaining to do Sunday, some of you. We come now to the part we've all been, I've said all I had to say about time. And does anybody have any questions before we move on? Make time to live. Okay, now we come to romantic love in marriage. I know none of you are interested in this, but romantic love in marriage. I point out that the ancient romantic love is a creation of God, just like every other kind of love.
The ancient universal order of things was to get married and then fall in love because you are married. The modern Western order is to fall in love, then get married because you're in love. This is a recent innovation that isn't working very well. I'm for it, but it takes a great deal more care. You understand, don't you, that in many cultures, and we talked about this, did we not, that you got married, your family or the community picked out a mate or helped you pick out a mate, and then you fell in love. The art of falling, and so what we're really talking about, this is instructive because we need to think about the art of falling in love after the wedding. If your marriage is going to be a good marriage, you have to learn the art of falling in love after the wedding. A husband and wife who have a marriage that works do not fall in love once and live off that the rest of their lives. They fall in love many times. This ancient order, we talked about this back here. Did I tell you the story about the fellow you stop me if I have. I was talking about the falling in love after the wedding where parents picked the mate. I'll tell you about this fellow up at Sanford. I was giving a family life seminar who said his grandmother his grandfather was dead, but his grandfather, they were from Czechoslovakia or Poland somewhere. Did I tell this story about they picked two and he could pick either one of the two. And he let the horse decide, let the horse choose which road to go down. Well, I bring that up again because sometimes horses could do a better job of picking mates than some people do, basing it on what they think is love. That's kind of a sarcastic thing to say, but been around as long as I have, I've seen some real wingdings of marriages. Now, the modern system is a weak system, and it requires two things. It requires, as I've already suggested, that we learn how to fall in love after the wedding. Secondly, if we're going to pick our mates on the basis of romantic love, if that's a primary reason we marry somebody, we are going to have to be very wise, informed, and disciplined to make sure we do not get that the person that we have fallen in love with is really the person we want to marry. You must never assume that just because you love someone, that is an adequate reason to marry him or to marry her. Understand, in and of itself, that outvotes everything else. It does not. A lot of couples have found that out to their extreme grief, that while they loved each other, they should never have gotten married. Now, romance is critical to self-esteem, especially for women. Everybody has written on their forehead, right next to the number 666, I want to be somebody's sweetheart. God has made us in such a way that we are never quite complete unless we feel that somebody loves us, but that is not simply brotherly love, but romantic love. As I say in the syllabus, no one can be complete who does not see himself or herself as an object of romantic love. I was going home last night listening to Janice Ian sang the song several years ago, 17, at 17, and she was expressing the grief of somebody that never has a sweetheart, a real sweetheart. And I think of older people who have lost their mates after many years of marriage, and they really suffer intensely. Why? Now, I'm not saying you can't get by, you can't live without being the object, being somebody's sweetheart. But something is missing, and people sense that. We know that, don't we? That there's a lack of fulfillment. We want somebody to love us. Now, I speak here of the importance of romance in avoiding the adultery curve. Normal to new to normal. Here's what I mean by that. Often, and here's the pattern that happens in hundreds and thousands of homes, including Christian homes. You know, a fella and a gal will get married, And then they will, for whatever reason, let romance go out of their marriage. And then one or both of them will seek romantic excitement outside the marriage and sometimes find it. The first marriage is destroyed. And then guess what happens to the second marriage? After a few years, romantic excitement and love goes out of that marriage too, for the same reason that it went out of the first one. Do you realize, you know, don't you, that once a couple has been, a person has been divorced and remarried, the chances of their getting a second divorce are about three times what the odds were of their first divorce. That is, most people who are divorced once are divorced twice. And if a person has been divorced twice, they have about an 80% chance of being divorced a third time. You understand? This goes up. Why? Because the person who cannot make it work in the first marriage usually can't make it work in the second marriage. And as soon as romantic excitement or love goes out of the first, out of the second marriage, then they're right back where they started. This is called the adultery curve, you understand? To normal, to nude, back to normal. The normal becomes unacceptable, you look for something new. Now, two things about this. How do we avoid the adultery curve? And this is a real problem in the church as well as in the world. Number one, we do not accept modern pornographic standards of sex romance. This is one of the real damaging things about pornography. Pornography is addictive. And pornography, when a man or a woman, especially a man, begins to use pornography, one of the things that happens is that he becomes dissatisfied with the sexual relationship he has with his wife, because he confuses that which is perverted with that which is exciting, and it is exciting, titillating, stimulating, but it is not healthy, nor is it normal, but it is addictive. Pornography destroys many marriages. That is, you see, the sex, now listen to this, the airbrushed sex presented in pornography is phony. It does not exist in the real world. That is, in the way there are imitations of it. And those who read pornography and then go looking for the real thing do not find it. Because it's a myth, it's fiction. Women do not like to be abused and humiliated, which is one of the key elements in pornography. You understand? And a man will read pornography, and it'll become a part of his thinking. And you know, don't you? Anything you read that is pornographic or of that same character, you carry it with you the rest of your life. You never put it down. It becomes a part of you. And so I give that as an example. In the real world, he finds out that women don't like to be used and abused and humiliated. And so, what I'm saying is, now there are different versions, the different degrees or levels of this, but my first thing I'm saying is that we must not buy into the modern Playboy / pornographic concept of sex and romance. You see, our society tells us that sex is the be-all and end-all. We'll come back later when we talk about sex, but I'm just going to touch on that. I'll just touch on it here. Let me return to that subject when we come to it in the syllabus. The second thing we say about how to avoid the adultery curve is, this puts us right back on our target, is that we, rather than the smart person, rather than look if things are stale or otherwise unacceptable, if the romantic excitement has gone out of the marriage, the smart person does not look for romantic excitement with somebody else. What he does is he brings in or keeps romantic excitement in the marriage that he's got. Yeah? The smart thing to keep romantic love alive in the marriage that you have. And that's the challenge. It's also a great deal of fun. It's hard to marriage is not the thing that God intended it to be when romantic love goes out of there, and it can go out. Now, what do we do? The importance of romance, I emphasize, this is very important what I'm teaching you now. The importance of romance, I mention here, in maintaining the primary roles of husband and wife when children are born. What do I mean by that? Here's what happens in many homes. That when husband and wife, when a couple gets married, the husband-wife relationship is the primary relationship simply because it is the only relationship. And then come the children. And something happens. I wonder how many of you in here, how many of your parents call each other mom and dad? I don't want to see any hands. My parents did that. Call each other mom and dad when they're speaking to them directly. Now, I was raised that way, and I never thought anything about it. And when we were married, my wife and I, Linda, whom you've met, we were married 3 years, and then LeAngela came along, and you get used to the kids. Begin to grow up, you'll say, go give that to your mother, and you'll, something like that. And then one day I turned to my wife and I addressed her directly as mother. I thought, I was from my dad to do that. And boy, she stopped me right there. She said, you drew the line on me. And she was right. She said, don't you ever call me mother again. I'm not your mother. She was right. I didn't look a thing like my mother. And what she was saying was that she was still Linda. She was still my sweetheart. She didn't understand. So what happens in many homes, and when nobody thinks about it, is that when the children come along, the primary relationship becomes the parent-child relationship. The husband-wife relationship becomes secondary. And I'm not making that up. So that, and the person who suffers most in this is the wife. Many women will say this, I'm nothing around here but the maid. You see, there she exists. Now listen to me. We're going to come back to this when we talk about the art of being a parent. But one of the silliest things you can do is when that darling little baby comes along, you make it the center of your life. There's a difference between normal parental love and simple weak-mindedness. And I have seen people with master's degrees become simpering, weak-minded idiots when a little baby comes along. And all of a sudden, their whole life revolves around that baby. They can't go anywhere or do anything. The first question is, what does Junior want? And it goes on from there. And pretty soon, the husband-wife relationship deteriorates. Why? Because the man functions as the father of these darling children, the woman functions as the mother of these darling children, and this happens time and time again. What happens when the last darling little child graduates from high school and goes the way to college, or graduates from college, or gets married? You got two strangers who get a divorce, and there's a huge number of divorces that take place as soon as the birds are out of the nest. Why? Because what happened was that the parent-child relationship outvoted the husband-wife relationship for so long and so intensely that there was nothing left. And that really happens. And it happens a lot. And it's bad business. So what do you do? Well, if we maintain romance in the marriage, it maintains the primary role of husband and wife. The rule at our house is and was, look, we got here first, we invited you, you're welcome to come along for the ride, but your turn will come. What I recommend to you is this: when you have children, live your life and take the children along for it. They'll like it better, they'll be more comfortable, they'll be more secure. Do not live for the children. Children do not want that burden. Children become bedwetters and tantrum throwers and all kinds. When they become the center of you will disable that child. That child will grow up to be a spoiled, obnoxious snot. And the only difference between a little spoiled, obnoxious snot and a big one is about 140 pounds. I know 20. I can name 22-year-old people who are obnoxious little snots. They just weigh a lot. And how do they get to be that way? Well, you see, their parents live for them, and they expect the teachers to live for them, and they expect Bob, the college professors, to live for them, and they expect employers to live for them, and it doesn't work. Now, so romance. The rule is, you see that kid, you see that lady around the house? That's my sweetheart, that's my wife, we're in love. Now, romance, dating. What I teach is that dating is more important after the wedding than it is before. It's also more fun, you don't have to take her home. Right? But it's very important to date after the wedding. Romance, there are fringe benefits to it. But first of all, it maintains its primary role. That is, you say to the kids, look, see this lady around here? That is not your maid. That is not your servant. That's my wife. Be careful how you treat her. It creates, what it gives to the children is security. You understand? If you maintain the husband-wife relationship as the primary one. Now, let me give you an example of this. I had a couple tell me one time, this is a very specific example, that they used to love to go out on Friday nights. That was kind of their date night, been married. And then they had this baby, and the baby didn't like to stay with babysitters, so they called off their date night. You see what's happened? They said, "Well, we'll wait till it's a little girl. We'll wait till she gets older." You see, they made a very clear decision there. Now, what I would say is, let the little kid get used to the idea. It won't kill her. And you go ahead and have your date. Keep this. A woman needs this, and women sense this. Men tend not to tune in on this. But a woman knows it. A woman knows whether her primary function, and what she is first of all, is his wife or his kid's mother. If you don't think that's true, you talk over with your parents, your own mother. They know. You can ask them, they'll just tell you. Now, romance in the home it furnishes a very important thing for children, and that is security. And I'm going to say this over and over when we come to that section of our study. Security is more important to a child than love. A child who is secure can get by on a little bit of love, but all the love in the world isn't going to help a child who has no security. It is the lack of security that destroys children. Now, and I used to do this as a scientific experiment. You ever do this? Some of you guys got little children? See if this is not true. I've done this many times. Sometimes I did it once in a while just to watch it happen. I've come home from work and my wife be in the kitchen, and in the next room you'd have a toddler or two facing the wall, looking the other way, playing with toys, thoroughly engrossed. And I'd grab my wife and go to kissing on her, pinching her buns, whatever I do, and hug it and carrying on. And she says, "Oh, quit it," which is hypocrisy to the in its purest form. And you're loving on her, and she says, "Oh, leave me alone, I'm trying to get supper, I said, "Well, you ravishing thing." And you go to kissing, and pretty soon you got something clamped to your leg. You ever notice that? You got this little kid come. You look down. You got this little kid looking up. Still in diapers. He's got to hold your leg. And often parents will say, "Well, they're jealous." They're not jealous. They're delighted. They want to get between. They want to get in on it. They're not jealous. They don't know why, but no matter what they're doing, they'll drop it, and they'll come, and they're just utterly delighted. And it works with little kids, and it works with big kids. I can fill my kitchen with teenagers. I grab my wife and pick her up, and she screams, and I go to loving on her, and I can get teenagers away from the radio. You think about that. That takes almost an act of God. And now, I'm not making this up. Instead of a little slobbering toddler, clamped onto your leg. You've got a smart aleck teenage son saying, "Go for it, Dad. Go for it." That's a direct quote. Why? Well, you see, it means a great deal to you. See, here's how children think without thinking the words. Here's how children think. Now listen, tune in on this. I'm right about this. Little children before they can talk, think this. As long as Dad and Mom are crazy about each other, I'm okay. I'm all right. I'm safe. This is why divorce is so devastating to children. Hurts them so bad. I remember one time Adam was about 8 or 9, and we were coming. I'd pick him up from some school function. This is my youngest son. And we were talking about a couple of his friends whose parents were divorced. And we were just kind of talking about it in a general way. And Adam took a deep breath. He said, "Well, at least I don't have to worry about that." He said, "I don't have to worry about that." He didn't want to worry about that. Now, you see what I'm saying? It provides security for the children. They love it. And when Dad dates Mom, and Mom and Dad are crazy about each other, it creates a mood, a tone, a sense of security in the home that is, in my opinion, is more important than love, if you have to choose between the two, which you don't. Now, and it creates a healthy attitude toward the opposite sex in our children. I recall children like this. I recall my oldest son, Aaron. Aaron will be in school next year. She can remind him of this. We're going to talk about this. Aaron was the classic textbook compliant child. And I'll say more about that later. But Aaron, when he became a teenager, when he went through puberty, all of his hormones went to his mouth. As often happens with teenagers. He got real mouthy. Still is. I love him, but sometimes I have to make him be quiet. And he was just getting about, you know, one foot solidly in puberty. And he really, the old term is sassed, mouth off to his mother. And so I said, "Aaron, you go to your room." He went, and I went in and closed the door and started talking to him. He was tickled to death I was talking to him. He thought he was dead. And he was agreeing to everything I said. You know, when you get a kid in that position, he's just, "Oh, yes, sir," you know. And because I was furious. And I said to him, I said, "Aaron, I'm going to ask you a question." I said, "You know your old man. You've been living with me 14 years now. You know your dad pretty well." "Yeah, Dad, yeah. I said, "Let me ask you a question. Suppose a perfect stranger, the man across the street, talked to your mother the way you just talked to her. What do you think I'd do?" He thought, you know. He didn't know, and I said, "But I'd do something." "But oh yeah, you'd do something." I said, "That's right, because nobody talks. I'm in love with that woman. I'm crazy about her. Nobody talks to my wife that way, not a stranger, and not you." And I said, "Aaron, don't let me ever hear you talk to my wife that way again." You see, that's a different thing than saying, "Don't ever talk to your mother that way." And I made a point not to say, "Don't talk to your mother that way." And he liked that. Scared the liver out of him. But he liked it. Why? You see, I have that responsibility to my wife. I want my kids to know that my wife's a very kind, loving person. But be careful how you can't push her too far. Why? Because you push her too far, and there's this guy hanging around the house who's crazy about her, and you run into him. And he always takes her side, even if she's wrong. "Daddy, that's not fair." "That's okay, I saw her first." "She got here first, you know, and I sleep with her, and I'm in love with her. You came along later." But that, you know, and kids have this keen sense of justice. They'll say, "That's not fair." I say, "That's right, we plan it that way. Life is not just, so your mother and I have tried to plan some injustice into our home to prepare you for life as it is." See, they won't kill them. You understand? But let me tell you, parental unity, we're going to come to this later and talk about this one. Parental unity is more important than anything else. You know, Dad, you always take her side. That's right. Why? She and I are in love. And what it does is it gives them a healthy attitude toward the opposite sex. Let me tell you something, fellas, especially if you've got little children. You better teach your boys how to treat a woman. And girls, ladies, when you're a mother, you better teach your daughters how to treat a man. If you don't, you're going to end up raising your grandchildren. You understand? I'm very serious about this. I want my boys to know how to treat a woman. So when they marry a good woman, their marriage will work, because I've raised one set of kids. I don't want to raise my grandkids. I want to spoil them and play with them and then give them back. That's what I plan on doing. I've been reading books on the subject, how to ruin grandchildren. No, not really. I'm very serious about this. How do boys treat, for instance, a lot of guys, when they start dating, their attitude is they'll go after a girl and get everything they can get. Push it as hard as they can, go as far as they can. Where'd they get that attitude? Well, listen, if a boy feels that way, his dad is failing. You understand? You need to be able to say to your boys, Aaron, Adam, Joe, Charlie, all your life, you're going to need to know how to treat a woman. You just watch your old man. I'll show you how to do it. Now, it may sound arrogant, but that, how else are they going to learn? One of my favorite memories, I bought Linda a rose or something and was sitting on the coffee table, and Aaron came in from football practice with his practice clothes on, you know, grubby, you know, and come lumbering in, left his shoes at the front door, and lumbered past through the living room on the way down the hall, and he glanced over at the rose. I was sitting in the next room, and he just glanced over as he went by, didn't stop and look at it, just glanced over as he went by, and just said to himself, I overheard him, said to himself as he went down the hall, he said, well, Dad's at it again. I don't know what he thought I was at. But I got thinking about that. I thought, yeah, that's right. That's exactly what I want him to think. Dad's at it again. Why? Because when he gets married, I want him to be at it. I want him to be keep romance in his marriage. And I want him to marry somebody he can treat with respect. And treat her with respect. What does that mean? Dating.
I remember one time when the girls were both in junior high age or about then, I took Linda out for an evening, a dress-up evening. I mean, a really dress-up evening. And the girls were old enough to babysit. That's why we had the girls first, so they could babysit the boys, and I could save all that money. And they fussed with her. You know, Mother, you're not going to wear that. Surely you're not going to wear that. You know, and she changed clothes about three times, and they helped pick out the earrings and went with it and gave her their advice and fussed like an old mother hen, you know. They had a great time. They just really enjoyed it. And when she got home, and she looked like $1 million. Went out the door. The manager told me what to have her home by 11:30. And I didn't. But what I'm talking about is the delight. They just enjoyed that. They enjoyed that. Now, how to treat a woman. It means dating and flowers and cards and I love you and I'm not talking about demonstrations. I'm talking about, but you see, I want my children to know that I'm in love with my wife, that we're sex partners, that we're sweethearts. That's a part of life. I want them to know that. That's the primary relationship in the home. Why? Well, I've already suggested the reason. When the kids are gone, I don't want our marriage to go with them, for one thing. And you can fall in love with almost anybody if you want to. You have, but romantic love, what I'm teaching you students is this. Romantic love has to be cultivated. You see what happens when you're young, and most of you are at this age, you think of romantic love as something that ambushes you. You sort of go along and it hits you from behind. You didn't plan it. This is the soap opera concept of love. Well, I didn't plan it. You know, the soap opera, you get this adulterer or this adulteress on the soap operas, and they'll say, well, you know, I didn't plan it, it just happened. Or that line, I didn't plan it, it just happened. I feel, you know, we're going to go to the divorce, the kids are going to be left, and I'm going to marry this other person. Why? Well, you know, I just sort of, it just happened. I was it's like catching the measles or getting ambushed by a thief. I was just walking along and all of a sudden just jumped on me and I was helpless. I have one comment on that. It's baloney. That's spelled B-O-L-O-G-N-A. Baloney, pronounced. Listen, love, romantic love, is a matter of choice. And whether there is romantic love in your marriage or not, it will be a matter of choice. We are not at the mercy of romantic love. It is not a matter of chance. Did you get that? And you're going to be just as much in love after you get married as you choose to be. But you're going to have to work at it. Now, women know this. Women have a sense of romance that most men do not have. That is, the average woman has a keener sense of romance than the average man. Although, men of this generation, you young men, are better at it than my generation was, and my generation was better at it than my father's generation was. But if you grew up in a home, fellas, where you knew your mom and dad loved each other, but your dad never dated your mom. They never let anybody know that they were sweethearts. Then you've got to learn it, because you will not do it naturally. You've got to learn how to do it. Now, I mentioned here the matter of treating one another well in public. I could have put this in a couple of places. I decided to put it in here. It touches directly on romantic love, but it goes beyond the concept of romantic love. So what I want to say this is that there are a few things in a marriage that are more important than how you treat one another in public. I'll tell you, the trashiest, tackiest thing you can do is to argue in public, put each other down in public. It humiliates everybody in hearing distance. And have you ever seen it happen? A man and his wife, and they'll get in public and take pot shots at each other, put each other down. And sometimes when the other person isn't present, we had an elder, remember Clay Hinkle? One of our elders up in Ohio. He used to say this, and he worked in a factory with a lot of rough men, and I've worked in a factory with a lot of rough men. And certain men, they take delight in running down their wives, talking, making fun of their wives with the other men, my old woman. And I always despise that. And Clay Hinkle said this. He said that he would never trust a man who would talk about his wife to other men, put her down. He said a man who won't respect his own wife, he wouldn't respect anything else. He would never have anything to do with it. And what do you say about your wife? And how do you treat each other in public? Do you open the door for her? When you're out with other couples, do you criticize, put down, contradict? Listen, fellas, if you're out with two or three other couples, and she's telling a story, and she gets it wrong, forget it. Don't correct her. Unless it's some little, you know, niggling thing, some piece of humor. But you know, elevate her. And there's a thousand different ways to do it. And you can think of ways, but let me ask you this question, teach it this way. Have you ever been out with a couple, been in the presence of a couple, maybe young, maybe not so young, and you can tell right away that he's crazy about her, she glows, he can make her glow in public. He can say the little things that says this is my wife. Boy, isn't she something? I'm so proud of her. And she reflects that, you know, gets that message across. And there's a lot of subtle ways to do that. Or, this is my husband. I'm so glad to be seen with him. Don't you wish you had him? I'm proud of him. And he glows. You ever seen that happen? They actually glow in public. How do you treat him in public? Do you, is it, it goes beyond common courtesy.
Listen, you fellas, if you humiliate your wife in public, then you're fouling your own nest. You're destroying your own life. Because your wife is your life, your one flesh. And I see students do this. Very hard for me to keep my mouth shut. Sometimes I don't always promise to do it, but I see young students who put their wives down, humiliate their wives, just be rude around other people. Don't see it very often. See it once in a while. There are a few things more important than how you treat your mate in public. Any questions or comments on this? You have anything to add? You agree with this? Yes?
I have a question. You're talking about how guys should treat the girls, you know, better, like opening the door and moving inside and them a lot. They get really upset when you do that. They feel like you're thinking that they're helpless and they can't do it themselves.
Then straighten them out.
That's what I think in your mind.
But if a woman is independent enough to handle things on her own, shouldn't she, you know, I mean, there are times.
That's okay.
There are times that a woman can do things for herself just fine without the man's help. And if she doesn't want the help, but he insists on doing it, can't she put him in his place and say...
Well, it depends on what it is. But if a woman is so independent that she's going to be systematic... Listen to what... This is a very good question. I know you're not... I'm going beyond your question. But listen, if you're so independent that you systematically get offended when the man in your life does something for you. If you haven't married him yet, don't. Stay single.
Okay, what happens if it's not the man in your life? It's just some other young gentleman.
Somebody you're dating or something.
You're in a group. No, not necessarily dating, just you're in a group. And
a woman, listen, if a man wants, now it can go overboard. There are cases. But if a man wants to be a gentleman, you ought to let him. Not very many of them around.
There are not, and John was talking about, that many women in this world who do not, who seriously don't enjoy having a door opened, are being treated like a lady by a gentleman, unless she's just some berserk woman's liver who's just off left field somewhere.
That's right.
Most of them will, even if they are into it, just to say that they will. They may not be used to it, and you may have to let them get used to it.
Remind them that, you know, that allow me to help you,
or things like you're crossing a busy street, you take their arm, you say, well, I can get across the street by myself. That's not the point.
But in a way of saying the girl...
I mean, do things for him. Like, I mean, listen to this. She brings the girl, you know, she's been grocery shopping. What do you do in? You say, honey, let me carry the groceries in for you. And you do it. Gentlemen. Doesn't mean she can't do it.
Just some things look like it's a woman's weak and the man's got to do it.
Yes.
That's
like, isn't that a lot of time how the man comes across with them, that they get that impression?
Yes.
How the man comes across with them?
Yes, but you don't. But you see, you're creating a mood. Uh-huh. Listen, a lot of this is game playing. There's nothing wrong with playing games. We play games all the time. You create something. You don't just let it happen naturally. And so you do things you don't have to do because you're creating something. Your question is an excellent question. I don't want to leave it too far. Yes?
I think it's nice to be independent stuff. But whatever you do, you don't humiliate the guy. Even if it's just your friend, you don't ever humiliate him out in public by saying, or you may not, there may be nobody else around, but if you stand there and you say, I don't want you to open the door, don't do that, they're going to get humiliated. It's going to cut them down.
And if he's worth marrying, he'll say to you, if I want to open a door, I'll open a door. I don't ask your permission to open a door.
It's kind of funny that, you know, sometimes the girls don't like you to open the doors, you know, some girls, but, you know, my philosophy has always been, when I do open a door, I mean, that's something that I've always wanted to do for a girl, and if she can't appreciate that, then to me, I'm not marrying a lady, I'm just marrying another guy. I don't pay people like that. Another thing that really gets to me, and I'm not sure it gets to other guys, is when you open a door and they don't say thank you. I mean, you just feel like shutting, or anybody, not even just the first of the day. Not even just the first of the day, but, you know, if I open the door for, you know, anybody, you know, a lady or something, they should say thank you.
Well, not, but if you're together for an evening, you wouldn't say it every time. That's
oh, right, right. But, I mean.
Yeah. Leslie?
What about when the couple systematically cuts each other down, and they do it, and they're actually planning, but...
Well, there's
they're
a
not like teasing, they're not.
But there's a hook in it.
Ridiculing each other, I mean, they'll be in
it. They keep it up, they don't know.
They won't be kissing each other.
Are you talking about where they're it's pseudo, are you talking about where it's pseudo humor, where that it's funny, but really they're digging?
Private jokes between each other.
Well,
it's not that. It's when you say that sarcastically,
you can do. Yeah, right. I was only kidding. I was only kidding, but you weren't kidding.
They keep a thrive on it.
Well, I'd say that that's going to come back and haunt them. Because, again, you're creating something that's ugly. It may seem harmless at the moment, but hear me. You're creating a mood. You create a marriage. You create a relationship. And... Now, I want to come, it's time for our break. After our break, I want to talk about, because of your question, this independence, how this fits in versus dependence.